So because I know who I am a lot more, I'm able to see other people for who they are. And I also like to judge people on how I am.
Bob, at the age of 25, I was £50,000 in debt. Quoted, what went wrong?
I didn't know how to manage money. I didn't know how to manage my emotions around money. I wasn't taught by anyone, school or society, how to manage money well. Credit was too easy to get. Anyone could get a credit card and a mortgage back then. What, that was mid-2000s. And, you know, my money situation only changed by getting out of debt and making my first million, then my 10th million. And where I am now only changed when my behaviour around money changed and my beliefs around money changed to drive the behaviours. So essentially what went wrong is I was buying depreciating liabilities on credit, i.e. creating debt on credit cards to buy depreciating liabilities. So the debt accrues interest and therefore you owe more. And the thing that you buy goes down in value and therefore depreciates more, so you lose twice. And it was only until I educated myself around money that changed.
How did you educate yourself? Because schools, unis, colleges, from my experience, they're bullshit when it comes to finances, taxes and real world stuff. How did you educate yourself? Because they don't.
Yeah, I think if you want to be a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, an accountant, a solicitor, then, you know, going to a good college can potentially set you up for a good career. It's no guarantee, though. But yeah, if you want to be an entrepreneur, for example, occasionally intellectuals and economists criticize my book, Money. I've done 200 million in sales. Name me an economist that has. Name me an intellectual that has. It's very rare. So I'm not a theory type person. I'm a practical reality type person. Look, it's a bit of a rabbit hole going down into why schools and colleges and universities don't teach proper financial management to start your own business, how to get taxes down. Ultimately, it's because it's not in their self-interest. People think that banks exist to protect your money. They don't. Banks exist to make a profit. So why would the system teach you how to not be reliant on the system? Because then the system wouldn't be able to make money from you. It doesn't want you to be a free, independent thinker. It wants you to get a mortgage and be in debt for 25 years and then remortgage it and be in debt for another 25 years. It wants you to pay into a state pension so you can essentially fund the state. It wants you to just keep paying taxes and not try and write off or offset any of your expenses. It just wants you to, you know, do as you're told. And I'm not bitter about that because if I could, for £10 million, buy a money printing machine that I can put on my desk and print my own currency, I would. Why wouldn't I? And the government have one of those. And I'd have one of those if I could. So I just want to educate people. This is the thing. My mission is to educate people to get better financial education and knowledge. I want to educate people to know how the system works. You're going to be pissed off at first because you've been told a lie. But then once you've got over your own emotion, you realize it's just human nature. And then you take the skills. Because actually money's an amazing tool and the banks is an amazing way to create profit. And you take what you learn and you remove your human emotion and your judgment and you go, oh, okay, how can I do that for myself, my family, my community? And that's really my mission. So the school system is never going to change. That's why I decided to launch my own foundation. I can try and change the school system. Why are they going to listen to me? Or I can create my own school system.
Let's talk about your family. They didn't support you. They couldn't help you.
Yeah, they did support me. And this was part of the problem. And I love them for it. But in some ways, the support my dad gave me helped me be entrepreneurial because he always taught me that there's work out there and you can go and get work out there. And if you want to earn money, go and do a good job. And it just so happened I was working for him from age six. But also, because my dad loved me and he didn't get anything really from his parents, he supported me at times too much. Helped me buy my first house, bought my first car, you know, paid for my school, paid for a lot of my college. And whilst I contributed too, I knew I could always fall back and rely on my dad. And that didn't serve me to be entrepreneurial. So he did it with love and I don't blame him for it. But you know, what I teach people now is you've got to build up your own skill set and your own ability to earn your own money, create your own business, create your own economy. Look, in some instances, if your main attribute is beauty, you might be able to marry into money. I used to be quite critical of that. I'm not critical of that anymore if you offer value. You know, my wife married me before I was rich. Well, she got with me before I was rich and she supported me, or, you know, and she doesn't work now. And I think that she offers equal value. So my tune's changed on that a bit. And, you know, some people will inherit it, but that can be a curse because you didn't learn the skills required to make, manage and multiply it. So really, I just took it upon myself to self-educate. And I've become way more successful through self-education than I have through traditional education. Uni and college, you know, sixth form, none of this. I did geography at GCSE, which is geography in French. I've no use for that, no functionality.
You haven't used that
No,
in
funnily
life.
Enough, I haven't used that to make millions. Yeah. And I did architecture and I haven't used that for any purpose. But all the stuff I self-educated with on, you know, following influencers and creators and reading books and listening to podcasts and going on courses. I mean, now, of course, I've become the teacher of that. These are the things that work in practical reality on the streets.
Definitely. December the 15th, 2005. It was the worst day and best day of my life. What happened?
My dad had a nervous breakdown in his pub in front of all of his customers. He got arrested and beaten up by the police, sectioned and diagnosed with bipolar.
Before or after your £50,000 of debt?
Oh, that was about the apex of my debt, because when that happened, I remember back at the time, I was a reasonably useful, maybe about a blue belt martial artist. And I stood there watching the police beat my dad up, and I really wanted to intervene. And I just froze and I couldn't. And I felt such a coward. And I felt such shame that, you know, what my dad went through, I felt partly responsible for, because he'd always tried to provide for me. And I was dependent and juvenile on his money and his work to be able to make my own living, which I was squandering. So one of the reasons it was also the best day of my life was because that was the first day of the rest of my life. I feel like I have two lives, pre-December the 15th, 2005, and post-December the 15th, 2005. And my life was...
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's Broadwalk. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
Going nowhere fast, and without this event to happen, nothing would have changed. It would have just gotten worse. But it forced me to get into property. It forced me to go and meet my business partner. It forced me to self-educate. It forced me to have. It gave me a reason and accountability to make some money. I since retired my parents. I gave them a load of money. Keep buying them a new car. Gave them a house. And none of this probably would have happened pre-December 2005.
Did this impact you mentally?
So obviously, I mean, everything impacts you mentally.
Yeah,
everything.
So you obviously,
like Harry's clicking is impacting
exactly.
me mentally, right?
So you mentioned
he's just trying to leverage you the time and do a bit of work. But
is that what he's doing right now on Twitter?
Yeah, of course,
or
he is.
On
he's
X?
He's out there getting big guests for our podcast. I know he is. Will I Am coming soon?
Really?
Yeah. Everything affects you mentally, but the question is, it's not what happens to you; it's how you respond to it. So. You know, anything can be a stressing or a blessing, depending on how you perceive it. And I think I perceived it as a stressing at first because I didn't know how to handle it. I now look back and realize it was a great blessing and it was the first day of the rest of my life. I'm not one of these guys that... A few years ago, I did talk a lot about mental health because, you know, there's a lot of people suffering. But there's this divide now in mental health whereby you've got this extreme, soft, entitled, woke society or part of society. Which is, I can't do a full day's work because of my mental health. And these people don't know that they're born. And, you know, their grandfathers fought in wars. But then on the other side of it, male suicide is really high. you know, that there are stresses and strains on life and women as well, but men, and there are real things that can affect you. So ultimately, I think mental health is about contextualizing what's going on. If your family has been raped and murdered, you know, then you're going to get PTSD from that probably. And that is something that is dramatically going to affect your mental health, and you should get therapy and you should get help. If you got a critic on YouTube taking the piss out of the buckle on your shirt, that's not, should not be affecting your mental health. So we've just lost a bit of context in the world.
Is mental health a trend? Because for me, it almost feels like this blow up of like LGBTQ stuff. It feels very similar to that.
No, you missed out the plus.
Plus. Oh, sorry. Plus.
Cancel, motherfucker.
No, it feels like that. Like 10 years ago, there wasn't these, like, what is it? There's 150, like, you could be 150, like, thoughts or something now, can't you? Like, do you know what I mean? What's the word?
You don't mean genders, do you?
Yeah, you can be like 150 genders.
Apparently, according to Kate Hopkins, there are two.
Yes, I agree.
Well, actually, there's two sexes. If gender is an identity, then there's an infinite number of identities. But sexes, biologically, there are two. Can you be born a eunuch? I think it's possible to have... So there's two and a bit genders. So there's two and a bit sexes. I'm trying to give you a viral short.
Yeah.
So bear with me, because this might be good for you. So there's two and a bit sexes, and there's an infinite number of genders. Because actually, if you want to identify as a goat, a eunuch goat, who am I to tell you you can't?
Well,
I'm probably not going to hire you, because I'm not looking for eunuch goats. But I reserve you the right to identify however you want. Don't tell me what sex I am or what sexes there are, but you can be whatever gender identity you want. Anyway, what was the question?
Anyway, the question was, do you think this feels sort of like a bit of a trend?
You mean mental health?
Yeah, because it is like what we've just spoken about. It feels like 10 years ago, no one battered an eyelid, and now...
Well, I don't know about that, because talk to anyone in the military or anyone who went out to war, you know, the Gulf War, Afghanistan, they'd say that, you know, mental health issues are real. So I think what you're saying is, has it become more pervasive on social media, and is it getting more engagement and clicks? Yeah, probably. But that's also good.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of people who've struggled with genuine mental health issues, and there's no awareness of it. What I will tell you is, if you're a man 50 years ago and you complained and said, oh, I'm emotional and my mental health isn't very good, you'd be ridiculed. And so if there's something genuinely going on, there's some PTSD or there's genuine illness, I think it's really good that people now feel like they can speak out. But then you've got that extreme left, woke, entitled people. And in a way, it's not their fault. Like,
I can't go to school because my mental health, because daddy shouted at me.
Yeah, maybe not even that bad. But we are a product of our environment. None of those people would be lefty, wokey or entitled if they were on the front line with a rifle in World War III. And that's why our grandparents were very pragmatic and stoic, because they had to go through a war. You can't really blame people who've had it easy. It's just that's what happens. You know, weak people, as a product of an easy society, end up creating a hard society. And then you need strong people, especially strong men, to toughen up and make society good again. And that's cyclical. And we're certainly at the point now where, you know, strong men are needed in the world. And I don't know how many strong... This is why people like Jordan Peterson and Andrew Tate are so popular. Because so many men haven't had a father figure, or so many men have become effeminate. And so, you know, there's this reaction to this by tuning back into what makes a man a man.
Do you think... You've spoken to Andrew Tate. You've interviewed him, I believe, on your podcast.
Yeah,
what's he actually like? Do you think he's... giving a bad perception to young kids out there who might take his content the wrong way?
Well, I think it depends who you are. If you're a 15-year-old schoolgirl, you're going to have a very different view than if you are a 35-year-old male. You know, what's Andrew Tate? 35, 36? So many 35-year-old males are going to resonate. 15-year-old girls, maybe not so much. If you're the parent of a 15-year-old girl, maybe not so much. He's very clear on who his demographic is, and it's male. So I can understand why, therefore, more females aren't going to resonate. My experience with Andrew Tate has been nothing but good. I'm a 44-year-old male. But he was respectful, polite, timely, responsive. We communicate regularly. And I see a lot of lost young men who they are finding guidance and almost a father figure in him that maybe they didn't have. You also see a load of people who've got not got their own identity, trying to wear clothes like him and smoke cigars like him. And you know, like... Yeah, you won't find me smoking a cigar with him because I don't smoke cigars. You won't find me getting pissed with Tristan Tate because I don't drink. So because I know who I am a lot more, I'm able to see other people for who they are. And I also like to judge people on how I am. Also, he's not currently yet convicted of any crime. If he becomes convicted of a crime and there's proof, then I'll address that at the point. But currently, he's not convicted of any crime. So a lot of, you know, social media has become the judge, the jury, and the executioner. And, you know... hit jobs on mainstream media, which haven't don't really seem to have come forward with any proof, are, I mean, mainstream media is dying, BBC is dying. And so it's really using Andrew Tate to stay relevant and get clicks and eyeballs and views with an ulterior motive, with a hidden agenda, with no transparency. And I really have a disdain now for mainstream media because of that.
Yeah.
Is Andrew Tate intelligent? Yes. Does he know what he's doing? Yes. Has he played the social media game? Yes. Has he made probably north of 100 million out of it? Yes. Would I do the same? Yes. Might I have said some of the things he said? No. Have I said some rather silly, flippant things in my life? Yes. Who am I to judge?
Would you say the most controversial things he said if you knew you'd blow up on social media? Is that important to you?
I think you've got to actually... Is blowing up on social media important to me? Yes. Does it create the identity of who I am? No. I know who I am and I know if my content is good. You know, Harry and I talk about this a lot because we're trying to, you know, if I have a podcast and no one watches it, I don't have a podcast. If I have a YouTube and no one watches it, I don't have a YouTube. But I always say to Harry, at the end of the episode, you know, whether I think it's good content or not. And if I think it's good content and Harry thinks it's good content, then that's good enough, isn't it? And if it goes viral, great. And if it doesn't change the identity of who I am. At times, we've probably tested stuff which is maybe a bit gimmicky. And the reason we've done that is because we need to be seen, otherwise we don't exist. An artist wouldn't paint if no one would see their work. It's not why they paint. They want people to see and experience their work. But you'd probably have to put in front of me the exact phrases, because some would probably say, no, I wouldn't say that. Yeah, I might say that. I'd probably reword that. It depends on the context of what I am saying.
I read something on your LinkedIn, on the train up, that said, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it said something along the lines of all these 21-year-old kids come to me wanting to come on my podcast and talk about how to be a man and how to win at life.
How to date women.
Yeah. Why did you write that? I mean, I know why you wrote
that. Why did I write that? Because it's the truth.
Why?
Why is it the truth? You'd have to ask all the people who want to come on my podcast. I like, on the one hand, I respect someone who goes out and asks a question. You know, there's people I'm trying to get on my podcast. Russell Brand. We've had some communication there and he's not yet replied to come on the show. He might say something about me. I'm still going to try. And I love a trier.
Yeah.
So I don't have any problem with anyone asking me. It's just, number one, maybe don't ask me before you can offer me something. I mean, I can offer Russell Brand probably millions of views, but Russell Brand might perceive he can get that anyway.
Yeah.
But I can offer something to him. Whereas what can a 21-year-old kid who's had, you know, a few women teach me about relationships? You know, I'd rather have someone come on my podcast who's been married for 50 years. I think they can teach a lot more about relationships than someone who's 21 who might have had four of them. And read a couple of online courses and now is the guru of them.
And watched Andrew Tate.
Maybe. And yeah, some of them have come from his community. And they've got this bravado, because Andrew Tate's got bravado, but the timing of it is wrong. You know, there's a couple of people who I want on the show, and I've asked, and they've declined.
Who?
Good question. Do I want to reveal that? Who's declined the show?
No, we only
know today, isn't it? Okay, I'll give you one example, the one I was thinking of. We've got Chris Williamson agreed to be on the show, who's very popular at the moment. And Harry's been back and forth trying to bag that. And I'm in Brighton, speaking on the same stage as him. And he's declined to do the interview there. So I've decided I won't ask him again. If he wants to be on the show, the offer's there, but I won't ask him again. Now, maybe he's got his own reason, but I value myself such that it's worth coming on my show. So you have to know, you have to have the chutzpah, is that how they pronounce it? To ask and face rejection. But you also have to know when to not beg. You know, I'm good enough to be on his show. Why isn't he asking me to be on his show? So I'm not going to beg him to come on mine just because I'm down there. I'm going to ask him once. And if he doesn't see it as value, then he can we can wait a year. And then he'll ask to be on my show. And this isn't ego, by the way. Because sometimes when I feel like that, I go, whoa, is that ego? Because I think it's important to evaluate your own ego. But I've been doing this for 17 years. And I've generated a couple of hundred million in revenue. And my story is not as well known as it should. And maybe not as told in as many places. And this is one of the reasons why these kids who made a bit of money in crypto, you know, wait 15 years. Let's see if you're still a millionaire. But then at the same time, fair play. So it's a bit of a paradox. Russell Brand's another example of someone. The offer is there to be on the show, but at the minute it's not done.
So you wrote a tweet that said...
Russell, please!
You wrote a tweet that said you've got a guest coming on that turned down Stephen Bartlett's podcast.
Yeah.
Who is that?
He's already been on now.
Oh, has he?
Tuukka Suliaman from Dragon's Den.
Why did he turn down Stevens? They worked together.
Because he's smart. mine was the first podcast he's ever been on. And he said the reason is he likes my no BS direct approach.
Yeah. Do you reckon them and Stephen get on? Really?
I don't know. I really like Tuukka from my time spent with him. And he has a bit of a ding-dong dig with Stephen Bartlett, doesn't he, about... You know, what does Stephen Bartlett know about business? I respect Stephen Bartlett and what he's achieved, but there's some pomp, pageantry, snobbery and bullshittery in there as well. And I've experienced some of that personally. But at the end of the day, I've not treated everyone perfectly. You know, so don't throw stones if you live in a glass house. So I try not to judge. We're in a similar space. He's done very well to get his reach out there. He's invested heavily in the show. Fair play. But, you know, he's not, he doesn't have a halo and a white gown like many people think he does.
It is very weird, the perception of him. People think he's this sort of god, this perfect, idolised person.
Only when you don't know who you are do you put someone on a pedestal like that. Yeah. To me, he's another human being.
Yeah. I used to, 5 years ago.
Used to what?
You used to put him on a pedestal. Used to think he was this.
Why don't you anymore?
My mindset changed. My thoughts changed. Like you said, he's another human being. He's nothing. Yeah, he's done very well. He's nothing special. He has interesting conversations. But my mindset changed.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, he's a very good marketer.
Yes.
You know, because every show of his is the most amazing show and with the most amazing guest, with the most interesting conversation. But surely that can only be one of them.
So, for those who don't know, which... Let's be fair. Most people listening to this will know is you're a very, very talented, incredible, hardworking,
good-looking.
Yeah. Hardworking.
Humble. Yeah.
Yeah. Not egotistical. Entrepreneur. What does your journey actually look like?
You mean the past, the present, or the future?
Past, present, and the future.
Well, the past is someone who worked really hard at the start after December the 15th, 2005, went and worked for a property sourcing company, learned on the streets how to buy property, went and bought a lot of property with other people's money, then wrote a book, then started running courses, then built the UK's largest property training company. We've got, 107 staff now in the training business. At times that's been, if you include all the online people, we might be near 125. We've been up as high as 150 before. We have the biggest property management company in Peterborough. We have 340 properties that we own, 1,350 tenants that we manage. I've written, 19 books. Now, that's my journey. That's what I've done. I broke world records for longest public speech. We've done more than 1,000 episodes on our two podcasts. That's just me. That's not a brag. That's not, it's more like a CV. It's facts. I think in some ways I've done pretty well. I think in other ways, if I'd have been a bit more, I became more risk averse when I had my kids. And I think I was more cautious. And sometimes I think I could have been so much bigger. But then I'm very happy with what I've achieved. Because if you can't be happy with what you've got, then you're always going to live in the past or the future. The past is I want my life to be like it was. The future is I want my life to be something better. And I've got better over the years at living in the present, which is, you know, yeah, I've got goals. Just finished my 19th book, nearly there on the 20th. So there's that, write those 5 to 10 pages a day, every day, stay present to do that. But then there's also the 3 and 5 year planning of the growth of the businesses. In some ways, I feel like I've done very well despite myself, because I was a big ball of negativity and jealousy, and I didn't have any skills, entrepreneurial. Well, that's not true. I did have some. So in some ways, I think I've done well in spite of myself. In other ways, I feel like I'm just warming up, 17 years in, 44. I think it's about now that the average age of the average person that starts their business, I've had 17-year head start. So in some ways, I think, yeah, I'm just warming up for a good next, hopefully, 40 or 50 years.
One thing I'm curious about is because I've spoke to entrepreneurs who had a goal when they started success, what success looks like when they started their business as opposed to now. What did success look like when you first started out after
Get
that?
Out of debt. I mean, to not be in debt was successful when you're 50 grand in debt. And then it's to make 3 grand a month, then 5 grand a month, then 10 grand a month, then your first million, then your 10th million. So, you know, you're normally pushing new levels. There has to come to a point where if you want to really grow, you need to serve. And so there comes a point where you have to stop looking at, oh, I want to be a billionaire, and start looking at how can I impact a billion lives. But there's no harm in being a little bit selfish to get yourself out of debt and get your first 5 or 10 grand a month in, because you've got mouths to feed, and you know that everyone's entitled to make a living.
What's your goal now? What's success for you now?
Yeah, I don't have one goal. I have many. I think goals are fantasies. How many people set goals? Not many. How many people achieve the goals they set? Not many. Because if you think about it, a goal is, I would like to be a billionaire. That's a goal. But
also a fantasy.
It's a delusion, yeah. In some regards. It's a fantasy because I prefer, what's my plan? What's my outcome? What's my roadmap? So I want to keep writing books, especially on the subject of money. By the time I'm age 50, I want about 6 million extra followers, give or take, and to be one of the world's leading perceived authorities, because all authorities are perceived, on money. I'll have to write a lot more about money over the next 6 years to achieve that goal. That's definitely one big goal of mine, which is why you're seeing a lot more of my content around money now. You know, Harry and I went out on the streets and started interviewing people locally about money. I've just finished Money Matrix. I've nearly finished Money Loves You. I might write The Creator Economy. I might write Capital. I might write Income. I might write Recurring Income. So, yeah, these are some of my goals. We'll always buy property. I'll always enjoy life. You know, I'll buy the watch. I'll buy the car. I'll buy the house. I'll go to the place if I want to, because life's too short not to.
What one thing that struck me there is one of your goals is you want 6 million new followers. Why do you give a shit about followers?
Well, how else do you get your message out to people?
Great marketing, great reach.
But isn't 6 million followers great reach?
So you could just pay £1,000 to reach X percentage of that people on Instagram ads?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I spend 6 figures a month on paid ads for my companies, and that's so you can force growth. But I wouldn't have to spend any if I had 100 million followers on social media and I knew how to turn those followers into finances. So I think maybe what you're driving at, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, sometimes the follower metric can be a vanity metric. It's not to me. You don't see much vanity on my social media. I only really post personal stuff 5% of the time, and it's because my social media manager tells me to. But my social media content is 99.9% work. And I build a following so that I can impact those people and monetize that impact. and you make a lot more money out of 6 million followers and impact a lot more people out of 6 million followers than you will out of 6,000 followers. And it's going to cost you a fuck ton of paid ads to reach 6 million engaged, interested people. I often ask people the question on my show, would you rather have £1 million or 1 million engaged followers? I cannot understand why any human would not choose 1 million engaged followers. Like, that says to me, if you choose the money, you're either broke, because 1 million isn't a lot of money nowadays, or you don't know how to make £1 million out of 1 million social media followers. But it's only £1 a follower.
But that's the important part, engaged. You could have 1 million followers and 10% be engaged.
You could.
That's irrelevant. That's pointless,
well,
right?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, you know, there's a lot of tomfoolery out there where people, you know, they've got what? Follower farming, and they buy followers. You know, I'll put my hand straight up and say I've probably tested 15 different agencies that can growth hack you and help you grow your following, and I'd say 14 of the 15 have ended up being shy. So at least 20% of my following is from them, and it's pretty dead. And so, yeah, that's irrelevant. But the reason I tried those is because I still live in the hope that, because if you can accelerate your growth, why wouldn't you? But, you know, we get loads of offers now, and we turn them all down. By the way, most people wouldn't admit that. Because I'm a marketer as well as what the other things that I am, and I'm always going to test, just like you might test Google ads, YouTube ads, Facebook ads, podcast ads. So let's say 80% of my following is natural and organic. Well, it's actually not within my control, my reach. It's within Facebook, Instagrams, YouTubes.
Changes all the
time. It does. Yeah. All I can do is what I can do. And all I can do, you know, we were talking earlier before we went live about Twitter. And I've been, well, X now. Yeah. And I've been informed that native videos on X are getting good reach. I will go where the reach is. And I will move away from where the reach isn't. So, yeah, I could have a lot of followers. If I've not got any reach, it's not relevant. But also, not having many followers is also not relevant.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to sort of pick your brains on is I see quite a bit of this on like Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, and X now. And I won't lie, I've been quite guilty of this in the past. Are these wannabe entrepreneurs? Especially when I started my business, I would describe myself as a wannabe entrepreneur. What are your thoughts on these people who want to be entrepreneurs, for girls, for Twitter buyers, Instagram buyers?
Okay, the first thing I would say is, what's wrong with being a wannabe entrepreneur, a wannabe millionaire? We're all a wannabe before we are. So if anyone is trying to start a business, you'll never see me criticize them. In fact, I'll support them. If I see them on social media and they're, you know, a bit of fake it before you make it, and they're trying to be and they want to be, fucking fair play to them. It's like an overweight person that goes to the gym. You will never see me ridicule someone who's got bad form or is overweight down the gym, because they're fucking down the gym and they're trying. However, if someone is bullshitting, completely fake, utter nonsense, blagging it, they need feedback, because, you know, that's on a mission for crashing and burning. So as an entrepreneur, I'm always going to be a little bit more sympathetic to people who are wannabes. There's plenty of things I want to be, so I'm still a wannabe. What the fuck's wrong with that? But I think what I've got better at over the years is I know who I am and I know who I'm not, and I'm not trying anywhere near as much to be what I'm not. And I am much more cognizant and balanced and aware of what I am.
You don't like the phrase fake it till you make it then?
No, I like be it till you see it. Because, like, why would anyone be attracted to a fake? But, you know, acting as if and implementing in real quick time what you learn and having the mindset that you are going to be successful, full support from me. But lies and bullshit and fakery, in the end you get busted. It's not smart.
Over the last few years, we've seen a number of like successful entrepreneurs such as Elon Musk, Richard Branson, go into a totally different industry. So they went into space. My question for you is, what's your dream industry to go into? If you had unlimited money, unlimited resources, what would you do?
Right now, I'd probably dump unlimited money and resources into AI. And the reason being is I think it's one of the most exciting, polarizing, dual use paradox industries that exists. It's moving quicker than ever before, and those that get AI early, they're going to win big. It's the new gold rush. There are certain industries that make money more easily than others. So if you had unlimited resources, you could make a fuck ton of money in the pharmaceutical industry. Just ethically, I can't do that. So actually, I'd rather be in the fitness industry because at least I can have a more positive, because, you know, if you've got unlimited money and resources, you want to go into something with the maximum amount of potential clients. So what's going to affect the most people? Because another thing I think is easy money is cosmetics.
Sure.
Because people will just, you know, as you can see, I've not had Botox and I refuse. And I get a few comments now from kids. I remember one guy, he had Botox, a friend of mine. And he was like, my forehead used to look like that. And he pointed at my forehead. I thought, fuck you. But he's 30 and he's having Botox. I'm 44 and I'm not. I'm holding on to my individuality. But, you know, all this, the amount of money that people are spending to not look themselves is fucking easy money. But, you know, people I know in this industry, they say all the people that come, their problem is much deeper. So that's an industry. Cosmetics is an industry where there's good money to be made, but ethically and morally, nah, I can't do it. So fitness, the good thing about that is you can make a real impact. I'll tell you what, if I had unlimited money and resources, I'd fight the government. I'd fight against, I'd spend trillions in advertising, going for walks, going to the gym, taking full responsibility for what's wrong inside you or what you don't own that's making you overweight and disencouraging you from taking this new super drug that you can take that apparently can make you lose a load of weight. And I would fight the system and get rid of all this bullshit. And you can, you know, clearly you can make a fuck ton of money with unlimited resources and unlimited money. And wouldn't it feel good? Because I remember seeing, it was on BBC, and apparently Rishi Sunak was very proud of this new miracle drug. For, like, I don't even take headache pills. If I've got a banging headache, I don't take headache pills. My wife's often saying, oh, you know, just take this, take that. I don't take it because I believe in my body. And I believe if I've got an ache or a pain, there's a reason for that. And yet we fucking drug up society, playing on their insecurities and allowing the big pharma to make billions. Imagine if you could make billions by teaching people stuff that really fucking works. Hot and cold therapy, 20,000 steps a day, you know, a good balanced diet. Wow, I'd love to do that.
Amazing. One thing I wanted to ask you about your podcast is you've had some incredible guests on here. One I was watching on the train up was the one with Jake Paul. I thought you were brilliant. Him, I
go on,
thought,
just say it.
He was think? A twat. He came across as a lazy,
Jake Paul, Jake.
arrogant, lazy, not wanting to be there twat. And I don't get why. Why do you think?
The human part of me likes to have some empathy. Maybe he had a lot of shit going on. Who knows? Maybe he'd had some bad news. Because do you know what? Most of my staff, when they're not performing in work, is because they've got personal problems at home. And if you understand that and you have empathy without being a pushover, that can be useful. You can be seen as a good manager. So the human part of me likes to think like that. Just like, you know, the human part of me has muchos respectos for Stephen Bartlett. But then, and by the way, I don't know if I've ever said this publicly, but I will. I donated a fair sum to his anti-bullying charity. Now, would I have got the podcast without it? Maybe, but I put a good sizable donation to make sure that that was done.
Might have been harder to get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, some people won't go on a show without getting paid. So, and yeah, he was apathetic, probably high, obnoxious. But one of the clips got, 7.5 million views on TikTok? If he'd have been all nice and pally, would that have happened? Maybe not. So it is what it is. I don't know. You see, I don't really know Jake Paul. And I really respect what he's done. I think he's been very disruptive in boxing. And I think he could change that sport. I'd like to interview him when he wants to do it. Because clearly,
he didn't really want to do it.
But the thing is, you either do it or you don't.
Do you regret giving that lump of sum to get him on at that time? Or would you rather
that donation went to an anti-bullying charity. So you know when people say, oh, what a fucking waste of money. That money goes somewhere. So for example, my wife and I were watching a series on TV called Lioness. And you know, there's this billionaire criminal. And they have this lavish wedding. And my wife's like, what a fucking waste of money. But what about all the little boutique-y companies that got paid? You know, the cake maker, you know, the furniture provider. So nothing's really wasted in that regard. That's not how money works. So I essentially donated to an anti-bullying charity. Being bullied myself, I think that's really good. in my ideal fantasy of how I would have liked Jake Paul to be, would I like to have him to be respectful and, you know, give me more time and enjoy the show? Yeah. But actually, you're not talking about the 990 episodes I did with 990 cool, interesting people who weren't disruptive and rude and obnoxious. You're talking about, everyone talked about Jake Paul or Chris Eubank, and they were the two, rude, obnoxious.
Because,
and everyone talks about,
because that lasts, right? It's this invisible PR thing that people don't see. People see them be rude, obnoxious, a bit of a twat. But where's your nice? You almost feel a bit,
well,
forgotten.
The problem is nice doesn't go viral.
I know. So if you want to say something rude, you crack on now.
Oi, Jake, fuck you, and come on my podcast for round two. Of course I'd have him straight back on. And actually, I'll tell you what, if I'd have been there, I reckon he'd have been different.
Yeah.
We always like to do face-to-face much better than Zoom. Actually, the Zooms are hard for rapport. Do you remember the one we did with Jordan Belfort? You know, that was a bit awkward and tense, and they're always better face to face, but we obviously weren't able to make it happen. I mean the Floyd Mayweather ones, Floyd at times he was pretty defensive and a bit
you can't break them in person as well, can you?
I mean, I'm not trying to break them, it's not my goal, and I have to be careful as an interviewer. Do I the human side of me want rapport, but what's going to make a great interview? If I had a public argument with Donald Trump, that would be much better for virality than if I had a nice conversation with a nice person.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm not saying that I like that or that it's right, but you know, I challenge my guests a fair bit more now because that's what people want.
Yeah. Anyway, finishing up, let's talk, moving on a bit from Jake Paul, boxing. You've had one fight?
Yeah, one and done.
Didn't go very well, did it?
It depends how you define going very well.
Well, you lost in 3 2-minute rounds.
The majority of the 1,800 people were in the room were in the room because I got them in the room. We raised nearly £250,000 for charity. I don't know if you've ever had a fight and raised that amount of money for charity.
Never had a fight.
Would I
don't
do...
Don't ruin this face.
Would I do a second fight and lose it to raise that kind of money again if my wife would give me the blessing? Yeah, I would. I fought someone 20 kilos heavier than me. I absolutely hammered him for most of the first round. I got a tame knockdown, which in any normal fight that's not overly cautious white collar wouldn't have been a knockdown. Most people thought I won the fight. Most people thought stylistically I was the better fighter. And so the only thing I lost was the perception of whether I won or lost to three apparently independent judges. That was the only thing I lost. Everything else, I won. I got significantly fitter and stronger. I still box, can probably look after myself a bit more on the show. Well, definitely can, considering compared to where I was. So I don't see it as a loss at all. I see it as 10 victories and one minor defeat.
Was the beef real with Samuel?
Yeah.
You don't like him?
That's a complicated question because I'm able to transcend my own judgment. Like, was he a good opponent for me to have in that fight? Yeah. Was he a better opponent than someone I'd be more friendly with? Yeah. Was he good at selling the fight? Yeah. Did he play, certainly to my audience, not necessarily his, but to mine, did he play the villain really well? Yeah. Did he take the fight seriously? Yeah. Is his life a lot better for fighting me? Yeah, he's still boxing. He's got another one coming up. I can't say that I dislike anyone. Are there things about the way he is that I wouldn't be like? Yeah. But it takes two to get in the ring. And you know, what we did was, like, there's nothing anyone can say that would make me think anything other than what we did was pretty amazing. Because do you know what I was told by the event organizer? Said most lower level professional boxers don't ever get to experience an event like this. Do you know what hundreds of people said to me? That was more entertaining than most real boxing fights. We put on a fucking good show. And so I'm very proud. And sometimes it's not about whether you got the one or the O. It's about how you showed up. And I gave him everything he wanted, and he beat me on a split decision in a really fine margin. if I'd have done four rounds, I'd have won. If I'd have done, it got him down to my weight, I'd have won. If there'd have been head guards, I'd have won. And that's a fact, because the knockdown wouldn't have happened without, you know, with a head guard. If I'd have done 16-ounce gloves, I would have won. By the way, this is not me giving sour grapes, because I'm sure if you were interviewing Samuel, he'd be saying, well, no, I won, and the better fighter won. Fair play to him. And also, I think I was pretty humble in defeat, and I let him have his moment. So how can that be a loss? I'll tell you who lost. Anyone who's had an opportunity to do something like that or even smaller than that and said no.
Amazing. Well, we've got a closing tradition on this podcast. It's one question, three quick fire answers. What three things is Rob Moore grateful for right now?
And my family, great people around me, and then probably equally my health and my wealth. Obviously, without health, there is no wealth, but I fucking love money.
Amazing. Well, Rob, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Cheers, Liam.